Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, four children in Colorado are dead from the flu, with symptoms as unalarming as a stomachache.
Also, billions for Medicare, billions more for Iraq. Can the country afford it?
And the strange case of James Yee, the Muslim chaplain suspected of espionage, is now being investigated for adultery.
And The Language of Blood, a Korean woman's story of her adoption by white parents.
How can I weigh the loss of my language and culture against the freedom that America has to offer? How many educational opportunities must I mark on my tally sheet before I can say it was worth losing my mother?
These stories and On the Road and In the Air and On the Rails the day before Thanksgiving, coming up Here and Now.
News is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The U.S. military in Iraq has detained the wife and daughter of Ibrahim al-Duri, a former top deputy to Saddam Hussein. NPR's Peter Kenyon in Baghdad says al-Duri has long been sought by the U.S. military.
Well, we've been hearing off and on for weeks now suspicions from U.S. forces and others that Izzat Ibrahim al-Duri, one of Saddam Hussein's top lieutenants, has in fact been holed up somewhere in Iraq and is coordinating attacks against American forces and Iraqi targets. Now, there are other reports that Mr. al-Duri is quite sick, and whether what he's actually capable of coordinating and doing, it remains unclear. But he is number six on the 55 most wanted list that the American military put out during the war. There's a $10 million bounty on his head. Clearly, they would very much like to arrest, detain him, and talk with him.
NPR's Peter Kenyon in Baghdad. The interim leader of the former Soviet Republic of Georgia says the country's opposition parties are coalescing around a single leader. That's Mikhail Saakashvili, who led thousands of protesters on the Georgian capital, Tbilisi. Georgian lawmakers are setting a new presidential election for the beginning of the year. Protest leaders say they want to ensure this election is fair and clean, unlike the last balloting that critics called rigged. The nation's highways and airports are crowded today as Americans travel for the Thanksgiving holiday weekend. NPR's Dave Mattingly reports.
AAA says the nation's improving economy and stable gasoline prices are among the reasons it expects 36 million people to be traveling this holiday weekend. Most will be going by car. Prices at the pumps have come down in recent months, though they're still 9 cents a gallon higher on average than this time last year. At Amtrak, spokesman Dan Stessel says they've added dozens of trains to handle the crowds.
This is the busiest day of the entire year for Amtrak, where ridership will exceed 110,000 passengers in a single day. That's about 70% more than we would normally carry on a typical Wednesday.
Amtrak expects more than 500,000 people to ride the rails over the holiday period, expected to be the busiest travel weekend nationwide since the September 11th terrorist attacks. Dave Mattingly, NPR News, Washington.
Colorado authorities say at least four people have died of flu-related illnesses this week, three of them children. The father of one of the children who died says it happened so quickly his child didn't even know he was ill. Colorado's flu outbreak is considered widespread, the most serious designation. Texas and Nevada also are considered areas where flu is widespread. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 31 points at 97.32. The Nasdaq is down 5 points at 19.37. The S&P 500 down 2 at 1,051. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, a California appeals court has significantly reduced a record-setting jury award against Ford Motor Company. Detroit Public Radio's Craig Folley reports.
In 1993, a rollover accident involving a 1978 Ford Bronco killed three members of a family near Sacramento. The surviving family members sued Ford, saying the design of the Bronco's roof added to the injuries. In 1999, a jury awarded the family a record $290 million in punitive damages. At the time, that amounted to more than 1% of Ford's net worth. Now, the appeals court has reduced the punitive damage award to $23.7 million, less than one-tenth the original amount. The court says the change is in response to a U.S. Supreme Court precedent that put caps on large awards. The high court ruling in an earlier case said that punitive damages should be roughly four times the amount paid to compensate victims for actual damages. Both sides have said they may appeal the decision. Ford may seek to further lower the award amount. For NPR News, I'm Craig Folly in Detroit.
Japan is warning the United States it could impose millions of dollars in retaliatory taxes unless the Bush administration drops its tariffs on imported steel. The World Trade Organization has ruled the U.S. steel tariffs are unfair. The United States has insisted they are intended to safeguard U.S. steel interests. Dutch food conglomerate Ahold says it lost $144 million in the third quarter. The third largest food retailer in the world is trying to bounce back from an enormous accounting scandal that broke at the beginning of this year. Ahold owns several chains in the United States, including Giant Food, Stop and Shop, Bruno's, and Tops. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop features a variety of radios, games, and gadgets selected especially for public radio listeners at npr.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
For travelers today, heading down that endless highway, or railway, or skyway, with visions of family and friends and food dancing in their heads, all sorts of experts are counseling pilgrims on their journeys to keep their heads. Patience. In a lot of places, it's crazy out there.
This is the busiest day of the entire year for Amtrak, where ridership will exceed 110,000 passengers in a single day. That's about 70% more than we would normally carry on a typical Wednesday.
And that's just Amtrak. Everything else is crowded, very crowded, too. Airports, of course. And as for the roads, we're joined now from Providence, Rhode Island, by John Paul of AAA. Hi, John.
Hi, Bill.
John, how many people do you expect to be on the road today?
Well, nationwide, we're looking at 36 million people who are going to be traveling 50 miles or more from home. And that's a significant increase over last year. In fact, it's up about 2.5% from last year's number.
I understand this is the busiest travel weekend anticipated since 9/11.
That's right. And it looks like people are starting to get back to traveling. And Thanksgiving is also a time of year for travel where people tend to go visit family and friends more than maybe some of the other traditional, whether it's Memorial Day or Labor Day holidays. So we see a lot of sort of coming back to the nest type of vacations.
What's AAA's biggest concern when so many people are on the roads?
Well, a combination of things, whether it's traffic congestion, which is always a possibility. Road rage can be an issue, people not giving themselves enough time to go visit wherever they're going to go. So we really tell people at this point, try to be patient and certainly don't drink and drive. We even tell people, and we joke about it a little bit, after that big Thanksgiving dinner, don't get right back into the car and head out on the road. You're going to be tired. You're sleepy. You're not probably in the best shape to be behind the wheel of the car.
A lot of people behind the wheel of a car, for one reason, gas is cheaper this year, isn't it?
Right now, we're looking at an average of $1.51 nationwide for gas prices, about 10 cents more than it was last year at this time.
Well, John, as you track these things, is the weekend starting earlier? One thing we're noticing in the city of Boston, which is where we broadcast from, is that the city's practically empty, and it was practically empty at 9 o'clock this morning.
It's kind of interesting on how what is a single-day holiday, Thanksgiving Thursday, has turned into a 4, 5, and in some cases 6-day
extravaganza,
exactly. And that's one of the things we are seeing to a certain extent. People are really taking that extra day, making a 5-day weekend out of it.
And some even apparently turning Monday into sort of their travel day home.
That's right. We've started to see that a little bit more and more over the years, where that Monday has turned into either a travel day home, or for people that have the ability to be able to do it, leave from wherever they were for the weekend and head right to work.
Well, John, as someone who knows well the pleasures and perils of all this, what are your plans? You just going to stay put?
Well, I'm going to go visit a little bit, but not too far, hopefully, and I'll take my own advice and make sure I carry my pie on the floor so it doesn't spill, and keep the turkey in the back seat where it doesn't go anywhere, and enjoy my brother-in-law's recliner to watch the football game.
John Paul is Manager of Public Affairs for Southern New England AAA. He joined us from Providence, Rhode Island. Thanks, John, and have a happy Thanksgiving.
You too, Bill.
Four Colorado children have died of the flu, and nearly 3,400 people there are infected in what one Denver pediatrician is calling the worst flu season she's seen in 23 years. Two of the children who died had medical conditions that made the flu particularly dangerous to them, but the other two, an 8-year-old and a 21-month-old, were previously healthy. Dr. Chris Nyquist is the medical director for infection control at Children's Hospital in Denver. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you.
What do you think's happening here?
I think that we're having a very early influenza season. It initially started in Texas and has moved to Colorado. And we do know that children really are the initial starting point for influenza outbreaks in the community, and then it spreads to the adults and other family members. And we're seeing over the last 2 weeks about 700 new influenza cases identified at our hospital in Denver.
And how many are children?
And those are all children identified through our emergency department. Approximately 50 to 60 have been hospitalized. And when you look at those children that have been hospitalized, about two-thirds of those have underlying medical conditions that would be indications for having the influenza vaccination.
Such as
heart problems, lung problems, other immune problems. Vaccinating those children is key, as well as vaccinating the family members so you can try to keep the flu out of the house.
This must be panicking parents that there are 700 other children who have the flu. How often do children die of the flu?
Well, children die less frequently than adults. Adults over 65 usually die related to pneumonia and influenza. But we know that children really get the flu where they're not quite as ill sometimes as adults, but there's so many more children who have the flu, and they often get hospitalized. We annually see a few deaths related to influenza, but this year it's very early.
I would say four children is very high.
Yes, it seems to be very high at this point.
Well, what are you telling parents to do? We're hearing that Colorado's chief medical examiner is saying that there's some indication that the flu is an underreported cause of death in children, that there may have been more cases that maybe even they're going back to look at.
Well, we're telling family members that when you think of the classic flu in adults, you think of a high fever, maybe a non-productive cough, muscle aches, and chills. But in children, especially under 12 years of age, the symptoms can be very different. When you look at a small infant baby, they may just have a fever and not look quite right to the parents. A toddler may have a little bit of throwing up or diarrhea and a low-grade fever or a runny nose, and then moving up as you get older to more classic adult symptoms. The other thing we're telling family members is that it's still not too late to get the influenza vaccine because it may help to decrease how severe illness you have and also may prevent it.
And we know that there are different strains of flu and vaccinations have protection against the different strains in them.
It's a little bit of a different strain that is probably circulating now that might not be totally covered with the vaccine. But one of the issues that we have flu season all the way from now until the springtime, so there's nothing to say that we're not going to have another bout of influenza coming around. So there's two other strains within the vaccine that you may be protected from. So it still makes really good sense to get the vaccine.
And doctor, briefly, what happens? I mean, how can a child go from a stomach ache to dying?
Well, the child is infected with influenza, which can have lots of complications such as involvement of your brain, involvement of your lungs, involvement of your muscles. And for each different child, they respond to the viral infection differently. We know that if we identify a child within the first 1 or 2 days, we can actually give them antivirus medications that may help them get better faster.
I'm sure you're getting overwhelmed by calls from parents today. Thanks for taking time with us.
You're welcome.
Dr. Chris Nyquist, Medical Director for Infection Control at Children's Hospital in Denver, Colorado.
Well, this Thanksgiving week of 2003, historic legislation passed Congress, legislation that will affect every single American, if they live long enough anyway, Medicare reform. But in years to come, when Americans look back on the $400 billion Medicare bill, some say the question asked about it will be, how in the world did congressmen and women back in 2003 ever think they could pay for this thing? Robert Bixby is the executive director of the Concord Coalition. He joins us now from Arlington, Virginia. And welcome, Robert.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for joining us. Well, Robert, Congress passed in the past 3 years $1.7 trillion worth of tax cuts over the next 10 years. Meanwhile, over the next 10 years, Congress has just approved at least $400 billion in subsidies to help seniors pay for their prescription drugs. Your thoughts?
Well, I think Congress needs to decide whether they want low taxes and limited government or whether they want higher taxes and bigger government. Either one would be consistent, but what they're doing is cutting taxes and raising spending, and over the long term, that just gives you huge deficits. So I think that basically what we're getting here is a lot of pandering. People like low taxes. People like the idea of a prescription drug benefit, but they're not answering the question, how do you pay for it?
Congressmen are reasonably intelligent people. They can read these numbers.
Well, the problem is they also read polls, and they know that older people vote, and they know that promising tax cuts are a good idea. And it's tempting, particularly in election year, to try to do everything and hope that somebody else will figure this out in the future, and perhaps by that time they'll be out of office.
By 2030, Robert, 90% more Medicare beneficiaries, 77 million in all then, that will raise costs for Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, all those entitlements, 80%. Won't taxes have to rise to pay for all that?
It's inevitable that taxes will have to go up, particularly if spending keeps going up like this. Long term, the tax burden is going to be determined by the spending burden. And we can pretend by cutting taxes now, but really what we're doing is cutting taxes for ourselves and raising taxes for our kids.
Well, we just saw 8% plus growth in the third quarter. Can't we grow our way toward paying for these commitments?
There's no mainstream economist that thinks that we can grow our way fast enough to grow our way out of these long-term spending issues. The robust growth that we had in the last quarter is obviously a very temporary thing, and nobody thinks that we're going to grow that fast for very long. Over the long term, it's likely we'll have about 3% real growth per year. That's about what you can count on average. And it would take growth far, far in excess of that to be able to produce the revenues to pay for these things. So nobody's really expecting that. You sometimes hear politicians talk about growth being the key to balancing the budget, but that's more or less an avoidance device.
Goldman Sachs recently sent out a newsletter to its investors saying the federal budget is out of control. What impact will this have on investors, do you think, this Medicare reform bill, and more importantly, to the economy in general?
Well, I think that it's going to make investors leery about the long-term fiscal future of the government, because they can read the tea leaves here and they can see that we've already enacted huge long-term tax cuts, and now we're adding a huge long-term spending burden in Medicare, and inevitably that's going to mean an awful lot of federal debt. And so it probably will have an impact on interest rates when the economy begins to pick up here, making interest rates perhaps a bit higher than they would be otherwise, looking forward to all this debt. And eventually, if you run these deficits for a long period of time, it catches up to you in the form of slower growth, because the government has to borrow too much of our capital stock in order to finance its own budget deficits.
Yeah, and to look even farther down the line into the future, drug costs in the decade after the next 10 years are expected to be as high as $2 trillion.
Right. I think a lot of people focus on the short term here and say, well, $400 billion, we're going to have to borrow that, but maybe that's not so much over the next 10 years. But keep in mind, the real problem here is the long term. We could afford prescription drugs for today's elderly. The problem is what we're doing now is promising prescription drugs for the baby boom generation, and that's going to be enormously expensive. And, of course, it shows up outside of these 10-year budget forecasts, but it could easily triple or quadruple in cost over the next decade. And from my point of view, I think we're using the future of this country as sort of a fiscal dumping ground. All of these things are being put out there, and we're just saying somebody else is going to have to figure out how to deal with this. We can't make the hard choices.
Robert Bixby is executive director of the Concord Coalition. He joined us from Arlington, Virginia. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
In the search for a child to adopt, many parents look overseas, to such countries as Korea or China. But what does it mean for a child of Asian heritage to be brought up by white parents? That's the struggle that author Jane Jung Trenka details in her new book, The Language of Blood. Given up by her Korean mother in order to get away from an abusive father, Jane grew up in an almost completely white community in Minnesota. Jane Jung Trenka joins us on the line now from Carnegie Hall Studios in New York. And welcome, Jane.
Thanks for having me on.
Briefly, your Korean mother's story and your adoptive parents' story.
My Korean mother was married during the Korean War, and her husband was killed, and she was left with an only son. And her mother-in-law instructed her to come to the city to get remarried. So that's where she met my father. And together they had four girls, and two of them were given away. My American parents are Americans who have been on the same farmland for many generations. They're Minnesotan to the core, and they were infertile. So they decided to adopt.
How old were you when you came to Minnesota?
I was 6 months old, and my sister was 4 and a half.
And how old were you when you realized you were different?
I think when I was about 5 years old and I was in kindergarten, we had a wonderful show-and-tell day, and I very proudly brought my clothing that my mother sent to me the first Christmas that I arrived in America for show-and-tell. And I realized then how being different could be a very special thing. And when I got home and I started to ask my mother about why my Korean mom gave us away, I realized that being different could also be very painful because there were no answers to those questions.
Jane, let's hear a passage from the book, a book about that pain.
It is true that my parents wanted white boys. They wanted to name them Robert and Charles, and what they got was a nephew named Robert, a mean barn cat named Charlie, and two Korean girls with strange names that had to be changed. We are children who were not adopted because there was room for one more, or, as is the case more rarely, the adoptive parents only wanted adopted children because they felt it was the right thing to do. Mary and I are last resorts, consolation prizes in the fertility lottery, the children who came into the family to replace the biological child, the child who was really wanted.
Yeah. Jane, your parents here in this country were not abusive to you.
No. I think they did the best they could with the resources that they had and with what education was given to them, which was really quite wanting.
Jane, how did you eventually meet your Korean mother?
When I was in the United States for about 2 months, my mother went to the social worker's office and sat there until the social worker gave her my American address. And she must have sat there for a really long time because you're not supposed to get identifying information. This is completely against the rules. Mm. But she got the information, and my mother made contact that first Christmas, and if I believe what she says, as opposed to what my American mother says, she tried to make contact many times as I grew up. And when I was a junior in high school, I was old enough to stay home by myself and go to the mailbox after school. And I did that, and one day I found a letter from my Korean mother there.
Let's read another passage where you struggle with the question of whether you would have preferred not to have been adopted at all.
How can I weigh the loss of my language and culture against the freedom that America has to offer, the opportunity to have the same rights as a man? How can a person exiled as a child, without a choice, possibly fathom how he would have turned out had he stayed in Korea? How many educational opportunities must I mark on my tally sheet before I can say it was worth losing my mother? How can an adoptee weigh her terrible loss against the burden of gratitude she feels for her adoptive country and parents?
There's bitterness in this book, Jane, and that must be a difficult burden for you to carry because your parents who raised you in Minnesota did save you. Your own mother felt from a terrible situation, and yet at the same time, this deep yearning for the mother who raised you.
Well, I think international adoption is a big mixed bag, and there are many gains to be had by the adoptee, and there are also many losses. And I think the losses part is the part that hasn't been acknowledged in the general adoption literature over the past 50 years. Your culture is worth something. I mean, the thing that people, I think, are starting to think about certain adoptees is we're angry, ungrateful, bitter people, and that if we search for our birth family or entertain an interest in our birth culture, that this is pathological. But I think that being an international adoptee means that you sit in paradox all the time.
There are certainly families in this country who are raising with enormous love and commitment and respect Asian children, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly know wonderful adoptive parents, and I can see that people don't, of course, biological kids or adopted kids, people don't all parent the same way, and people have found really great ways to accept the child's culture as well as that child.
I'd just like to finish, if we could, with a memory of your mother, your Korean mother. You lost her to cancer only 5 years after you met her. What kind of a woman was she, and how does she still fill your heart?
My Korean mother was a storyteller, and she was so full of fire. And we had this expression in Korean, bali bali, meaning like hurry up. And she was always bali bali, and she had short little legs, and she could walk faster than I can run. And she was a woman of incredible, incredible strength. She had been through more hardship than I think we as Americans can even fathom. Mm. I sort of engage in this very folk Korean activity of praying to ancestors, which, you know, if I told that to my American mom, she would think I was completely off my nut, but I do it. I pray to my mother, and I think about her a lot. And the gift of the book is that now other people can think about her too, and in that way, she becomes real in a way that she could never be in my American family.
Jane Zhang Trinka is the author of the new book, The Language of Blood. She spoke to us from New York City. And Jane, thanks so much.
Thank you, Bill.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, why China may soon be building more efficient cars than the U.S.
And an update on our annual pilgrimage to see snow geese. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, the Army releases Muslim chaplain James Yee. He'd been held for possibly taking classified material. But now there are new investigations his lawyer says are bogus.
Only the Army would think to throw a charge of adultery at a person in the year 2003.
Also, handy tips for Thanksgiving from our resident chef, Kathy Gunst.
The turkey should come out at least 30 minutes before you're going to serve it. So you have a half an hour at the end where you can reheat all kinds of things.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. Criticism today for the U.S. occupation of Iraq from a man once in charge of that operation, Jay Garner, the retired general who headed the first occupation government in Iraq, says the United States made major mistakes, including disbanding the Iraqi army, putting too few troops on the ground, and failing to explain the goals of war. Garner admits he himself made mistakes. An official with the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq says it is unfair for Garner to criticize current post-war efforts. A top suspect in some of the recent attacks on U.S. forces in Iraq is still on the loose, but the military has arrested his wife and daughter. They were picked up during a raid. Isaac Ibrahim Aduri is number 6 on the 55 most wanted list. Last week, U.S. officials offered a $10 million reward for information leading to his capture. A major pipeline from northern Iraqi oil fields is ablaze. Witnesses in a village north of Baghdad say sheets of flames and thick black smoke are shooting from the damaged pipeline only 30 miles from Iraq's largest oil refinery. There was no immediate explanation for the cause of the blaze, but guerrillas have repeatedly attacked pipelines in the general area. The attacks have complicated efforts to revive Iraq's giant petroleum industry, the key to its economic recovery. Iraq has the second largest proven petroleum reserves in OPEC. The International Atomic Energy Agency has censured Iran for its nuclear cover-ups and is warning Tehran not to commit, quote, further serious Iranian failures. The agency indicated that any such failures could lead to more serious action by the UN Security Council. The U.S. had wanted the resolution to include mention of possible Security Council action, but France, Germany, and Britain oppose such a threat. More evidence today that the U.S. economy is rebounding. Manufacturers saw orders for big-ticket goods increase in October, the largest amount in more than a year. Meanwhile, the government reports that consumer spending was steady last month, while incomes grew by 0.4%. If you're traveling this holiday weekend, expect long lines at some airports. Air travel is expected to be up by about 13% from last year in what could be the busiest holiday weekend since before 9/11. The Transportation Security Administration says following the rules ahead of time may make things easier at the airports. This is Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Is the military out to get Muslim Army chaplain Captain James Yee? His lawyer thinks so. The Army says Captain Yee's being investigated for serious charges, including disobedience bordering on treason, as well as adultery and downloading pornography. It's a confusing picture because despite the investigation swirling around Captain Yee, He's now been released from 3 months' detention and been told he can resume his duties as a chaplain. Eugene Fidel is Captain Yi's civilian lawyer. He now joins us. Welcome, Mr. Fidel.
Thank you for calling me.
Eugene, what is your client's status?
He is being restored today to duty as a chaplain. He's been sent to Fort Benning, Georgia, and assigned to the chaplain's office at that installation.
Despite the fact that all of these charges, including charges of taking classified information unlawfully from Guantanamo Bay home with him, as well as adultery now and pornography, are still being investigated.
The government has added charges but relaxed the terms of his pretrial status. It's exactly backwards. The whole thing has a kind of Alice in Wonderland quality. At the beginning, he was said to be under investigation for espionage, I think, aiding the enemy, things that were potentially capital offenses. And now it's evolved into this really collection of trivial allegations. Only the Army would think to throw a charge of adultery at a person in the year 2003.
Adultery and downloading onto a government computer pornography. What code? Is that a violation of the code of military justice or what?
You can jam those charges into the UCMJ. With respect to the pornography, if I had a dime for every government official who had pornography on his or her government computer, I wouldn't have to practice law. I'd be retired and living in Florida.
Now, after his confinement, unnamed military sources were widely quoted saying that Captain Yi had become particularly sympathetic to some of the 600-some-odd Muslim captives at Guantanamo. Is that the shadow on all this?
Who knows? I think the original charges were part of a pattern of hysteria. At the time, remember, there was a senior airman from Guantanamo Bay who was charged with other offenses. The government arrested somebody in Boston at the airport. What prompted them to get this way? I don't want to speculate right now. I'm not a shrink. I'm a lawyer. And, you know, all of this will come out if the government insists on having a trial.
You're not a shrink. You're a lawyer. But what is your client's mood at the moment?
My client is very, very relieved to be out of jail. He was held in conditions that did not respect his status either as a commissioned officer, much less as a chaplain. So he and his family are deeply grateful. On the other hand, the unfortunate part is the light hasn't fully gone on for the government that they should just drop this case and let everybody move on.
What happens legally next?
They can't do anything until they have an Article 32 investigation, which is like a grand jury investigation, and they've assigned a colonel to serve as that investigator. But you can't have an Article 32 investigation until you give security clearances to everybody, and the government has been dragging its heels on completing the process for security clearances for me and my two civilian co-counsel.
Eugene Fidel is a lawyer defending Captain James Yi. He joined us from Washington. Thanks very much, Eugene.
It's my pleasure.
We spoke to the public affairs officer of the U.S. military's Southern Command in Tampa, Florida. He said Captain Yi has never been formally charged, only investigated, and he said that he couldn't comment on charges that Captain Yi was maltreated while in confinement.
Well, some 140,000 Americans are serving in Iraq or Afghanistan, and then there are reservists who will be in the States for Thanksgiving dinner tomorrow, but will soon leave for a year and a half of training and deployment to Iraq. Reporter Fred Tyes of WBUR visited one reservist company in Concord, Massachusetts.
The men and women of the 118th Area Support Medical Battalion, Alpha Company, in Concord, are getting ready to spend their last Thanksgiving before deployment. On this morning, there's vaccinations and HIV and DNA testing, and they're getting their finances in order. Major Jeff Laughlin is the company's 34-year-old commander.
We have access to the legal community for powers of attorney and wills, things like that, so to make sure everything that our families need to take care of themselves are ready and ready to go. And so our soldiers, when they hit the ground overseas, can feel confident that everything that they need taken care of back home is ready to go.
Alpha Company will spend 18 months away from their families, of which 1 year will be overseas. The medics haven't been told yet where they will go, but because of their emergency medical training, they're expecting to be assigned to a war zone. The unit's physician assistants are trained to provide emergency treatment in the field. 40-year-old Captain Scott Salloway is one of them.
I'm fully licensed to diagnose, treat, and take care of any emergency or well checks that may happen. I can take care of heart attacks, I can take care of broken bones, I can take care of foreign body wounds and any type of war surgery that may occur. I have to work under the supervision of a physician, but pretty much we function independently in collaboration with a supervising physician.
In civilian life, Salloway works in urgent care at the Mansfield Health Center in Mansfield. Salloway's been married for 15 years. He has four children, and he's taking them all to Orlando for Thanksgiving before their father has to go away. He's been talking to them about how he's going to take care of soldiers. In the field, the unit can call in Air Force and Army helicopters to evacuate patients. Company Commander Jeff Laughlin says they also have their own equipment.
We have 8 ground ambulances to go and retrieve and deliver patients to areas that may need our help.
21-year-old specialist Kara Chin, an emergency medical technician for Fallon Ambulance in civilian life, will be the unit's public affairs officer.
Set up a hospital, basically, is what we're going to be doing. And anybody who needs treatment or care will come through us, and we'll provide as much as we can and then ship them off either to a higher echelon of care or return them to duty.
In the military, these medics do more than they do as emergency medical technicians in civilian life. And it's not only because they're treating combat wounds. Their training is more specific.
We do go through a more advanced life support because we tend to deal with more trauma than we do anything else out in the field. So we do have advanced life support techniques that we learn, such as intubation, advanced airway techniques, IV therapy.
Chin lives with her boyfriend in Mansfield. He's also an emergency medical technician. He's working Thanksgiving.
It's been a rough time for all of us, but I'm sure we'll get through it.
Company Commander Jeff Laughlin's specialty in civilian life is computerized medical records. He's an IT specialist at the Boston Medical Center. His wife Suzanne works for a community care mental rehabilitation organization in Dedham. The couple and their 3 children, ages 10 weeks to 10 years, live in Easton. For the next 18 months, Jeff says it'll be tough as Suzanne raises them alone.
Most anything else, we're just reaching out to family and friends, probably more than we normally have. Certainly from my standpoint, for assistance around the house with the children, even some of the daily tasks of the pick up and drop off at the soccer games and the dance lessons and all that kind of stuff. It's really hard. You know, we used to have 2 vehicles, 2 hands, and now it's down to 1. So it makes it hard.
Alpha Company expects to head for more training here in the United States sometime in December before going overseas in January. You're listening to Here and Now.
As the expected, 32 million Americans drive to visit friends and family this Thanksgiving. Most of them will be traveling on one of the more than 300 interstate roads threading across the country. This seemingly random series of 1, 2, and 3-digit interstates is actually a carefully laid pattern designed to let us know where we are in the country and where we're going. The trouble is, nobody bothered to tell us about it. Here to make sense of how the American interstate system works is Dan McNichol, author of The Roads That Built America, The Incredible Story of the U.S. Interstate System. Dan, welcome.
Well, hi, Robin.
I know you're joining us on a cell phone from your car. More on that in a moment. But let's start with the roads that run north, south, east to west. These are the 2 digits primarily. How are they numbered?
The odd numbers begin at 5 on the west coast, and they get to all the way to 95 on the east coast. And then low numbers start on I-4 down south, and as they work their way north, they get up to I-90, okay, up to the very, very top of the country.
So now let's move to the 3 digits, or 3Ds, I hear that they are called. That first number apparently stands for something.
That first number is critical. If you're on an odd-numbered 3D road, if you're going on a spur, you're on a direct line in and out of a city. If you're on an even numbered, there's 2 connections. You come off and around, and it's a beltway, or it's at least a semicircle.
Okay, so let's give some examples. Here in New England, we have 495. It's a loop. And so that means that at both ends, you will get back to 95.
That's right. And same with if you were on a 295 or a 695, any part of the country. But the odd numbered, like 195 down in New Bedford, that is a spur taking you straight off 95 and shooting you towards the Cape.
So you only get connected at one end to the 95.
Exactly. That could be a 395, a 795.
Dan, I had always heard also that a 2, the number 2 in front of two more digits, let's say 280, means that that road is literally taking you to TO Route 80.
That's a great way to remember it, because when you're on 80 and you jump on 280, you'll know you get back onto 80 at some point. That's the beauty and the comfort of an even-numbered three-digit interstate. 1 or 3 or 795 or 80, that's a problem because that's just a straight line out like you know where you're going.
And now the system gets fouled up because often cities and states break the rules, number one, and quite often interstates don't get finished.
In Oklahoma, they were trying to connect with the turnpike in Kansas. And the Kansas Turnpike, a little wealthier state, Kansas was able to build their turnpike, connect to Oklahoma like they planned. But for a long time, the Kansas Turnpike dead-ended into a farmer's field in Oklahoma, the dead end, the state line. And cars were speeding down the Kansas Turnpike, blasting through barriers. They kept building the barriers bigger and bigger, but they kept landing up into this poor farmer's field. He would fish them out with his tractor. After a year of this, he was exhausted. Life magazine even ran a story about this. The governor of Wyoming and his wife took a trip through the fence, and that's when finally Oklahoma got some money to build their turnpike. But it was a great example of why turnpikes never worked. You needed an interstate system. You needed a federal government to build a comprehensive network.
Well, by the way, for those who are sitting in traffic somewhere, let's say, the Mass Pike, outside of Philadelphia or Phoenix, they're jealous of you because you are also traveling cross-country. But what are you in right now?
This is a dream come true. It's a 1951 Hudson. I think it personifies the love Americans had for the roads in the 50s.
Well, Dan, safe traveling.
Okay, Robin. Thanks so much for having me on.
Dan McNichol, author of The Roads That Built America, The Incredible Story of the U.S. Interstate System. He spoke to us from Route I-84 outside Hartford, Connecticut.
On the road again.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
Just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends. I can't wait to get on the road again.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Well, as we said earlier in the program, this is gearing up to be a tough travel day. Positive trends in the economy sending more people to and fro. Many of them heading to airports where they... What? What do you do now? If you haven't traveled in a while, you may be in for some surprises. Janet Liebert is the editor and publisher of Sky Guide, and she joins us on the line with some tips for traveling. Janet, I know when I recently went to the airport, I was surprised to see self-service kiosks.
They are the best thing that's happened to travel. It eliminates a line most of the time.
Mm-hmm. And what do you need to use one?
It is very easy. If you already have pre-purchased your ticket, any credit card will work. Just run it through the slide, and that's just to identify you as who you are. Mm-hmm. And then what happens then is your boarding pass prints out, and you head right to the security line.
What if you have bags to check?
If you have bags to check, there are kiosks that are separate that have an attendant there, mm-hmm. and once you do that same process running your credit card through, the attendant will take your bag and check it for you.
Let's talk about those bags. Can you lock them anymore if you're checking them?
Do not lock your bags. The TSA agents will screen all bags, and it's a random search. Mm-hmm. So if you have locked them, they will break your lock and search your bag.
I understand there should be a note in your bag if your lock is broken explaining what happened.
Absolutely. They okay. do leave a note explaining that they have searched your bags, and they give you an 800 number if anything's amiss for you to call and check in on that.
Now, last year, the big news was that you couldn't put cheese, chocolates, or heart medications with nitroglycerin into your bags. Is that still true?
You know, it's less true that they are working through all those kinds of bugs. The mm-hmm. machines are very sensitive, but it's not as much of a problem this year.
You still might want to keep cheese out of your
right.
checked bag.
But more importantly, if you're bringing gifts, do not wrap your gifts, whether it's in your checked bag or whether it's in the bag you're carrying on, because they will be unwrapped.
Mm-hmm. And we hear that stacked books and even fruitcake are sometimes too dense for screening devices, so keep those out of the bags, too.
Absolutely. You want to just make sure that the things that you're packing wouldn't cause someone to pull your bag off and search it. And those are the kinds of things, whether it's too dense or it has metal or if it's wrapped, those kinds of things will be called off.
Okay, carry-ons. Where do you put your computer, and can you bring tweezers yet?
You can bring your laptop, but you want to make sure you take it out of any bag and put it in a separate bin because they will check that separately. Tweezers you can bring on board.
Well, Janet, thank you.
It's been great.
Janet Liebert, editor and publisher of Sky Guide, a publication that follows the travel industry.
Tomorrow at this time, the turkey will be in the oven, guests will arrive from far and near, and oops, you forgot the cranberry sauce, didn't you? And by the way, who is bringing the apple pie? Well, if you're hosting a Thanksgiving meal, the preparation can have anything but a relaxed holiday feel to it. So with some last-minute tips on preventing your Thanksgiving from tanking, we brought in Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst to offer advice and counsel. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Bill.
We should also mention, Kath, that you're a cookbook author, of course, but your last book was actually called Relax, Company's Coming. Perfect title for this time of year.
Yes, it is. Much needed.
Give us some soothing thoughts for anybody out there who's in a bit of a frenzy right now.
Well, the thing about Thanksgiving is that people that don't cook all year suddenly find themselves
That's
in
right.
the kitchen with 14 people coming, and they're in a complete frenzy. I guess the biggest piece of advice I could give is to prepare ahead, prepare ahead, prepare ahead. That means set the table now, the day before. Figure out what you're going to serve dishes with. It all sounds kind of anal and obsessive, but it's incredible how looking for a serving spoon can trip you up at the last minute. Get your ingredients out. Have things ready. Know what you're starting with and what you're ending with, and do any and everything ahead of time. But probably the bigger issue is psychological, which is this is not about perfection. This is a time of reflection. It's supposed to be a time of thanks, and it's supposed to be a time of family. Again, I sound like a Hallmark greeting card, but it's not about, is your side dish better than the neighbor's? It's not about proving that you have a Martha Stewart dining room. It's about being together and sharing.
Just keep a method in the madness. Here and Now asked a couple of people, what problems do you encounter when preparing a Thanksgiving meal? We went out and asked around. Let's listen to the first question.
Okay.
My biggest Thanksgiving food problem is that we always expect to eat around 1, but don't end up eating till around 4. We can't really seem to get everything to come out at the same time, and the turkey seems to be undercooked a lot of the time.
And then everybody gets kind of hungry and the meal
isn't
right. What do you do, Kath?
Well, it's a really good question. Turkeys take a long time, particularly large ones. We're talking about, 14 to 16 minutes, depending on whether it's fresh or frozen per pound. So you really need to plan ahead, and you need to figure out how many hours the turkey's going to cook. Now, most people have one oven, and it's going to be entirely taken up with the turkey. Maybe there's stuffing inside of it. So how do you figure how to cook everything else and have it all be ready at the same time? Again, it's a lot of planning. The turkey should come out at least 30 minutes before you're going to serve it. So you have a half an hour at the end where you can reheat all kinds of things. Mashed potatoes, they can be done on top of the stove. They can be done ahead of time. Sweet potatoes, same thing. Let's say you're having steamed string beans with candied walnuts on top. Steam the beans ahead of time. Cook the walnuts ahead of time. Throw it all together. You want to think about sautéing and doing as much as possible on the stovetop. People forget. Oh my God, I don't have an oven, because they're not used to having this massive bird in there. So that's important. Her turkey being undercooked is a whole other issue. The biggest complaint I hear over and over from people is, my turkey's dry. You want to baste a turkey. What I do is I melt a stick or two of butter with tons of garlic and fresh herbs, and about every 30 minutes or so, I baste some of this gorgeous garlic herb butter on top of it, and I lightly cover my turkey after it's brown with an aluminum tent so that it doesn't get over-browned. And the turkey, if you watch it will come out just fine. If you're worried, take it out first. It's always easier to put it back in. Once it's overcooked, you cannot reverse time.
Still all sounds a bit like trying to conduct a symphony orchestra, but moving on to
well, you
good
know what?
Advice.
It's true. It's absolutely true. But if you sit down, and this is the time when all that obsessive behavior of list making comes in very handy.
As you say, just plan.
And ask for help. Don't be so above it all that you have to be the key orchestrator.
See, that ruins everything if you have to help. Here's question number two.
The thing that I would like something done about is reducing the salt content of everything they serve to you. Sugar, too, but putting sugar in everything and salt, that's what I'd like done.
What about it, Kath?
Who is they?
This is
a Big Brother thing. Actually, it's a really good question. The truth is that there are so many fresh herbs and spices you can use in Thanksgiving dishes that there's no need for a lot of sodium. I rely a lot on freshly ground pepper, fresh garlic, onions, thyme, rosemary, basil, and then all those quasi-sweet dishes like the sweet potatoes and the squash. You don't need to salt them. There's cinnamon and fresh ground nutmeg. Find fresh spices. It will make a huge difference. If you get a whole nutmeg and you grate it right onto the food, the aroma, the essence of it, all these spices really counteract the need for salt. In terms of sugar, I'm a big fan of maple syrup this time of year. It's a lot less sweet. A little bit goes a very long way. And the truth is that after a feast like Thanksgiving, you don't need that much sugar. I mean, we expect it. We expect a pumpkin pie. But again, use those spices. Use the nutmeg and allspice, and you don't need a ton of sugar.
Well, speaking of after a feast like this, what about after all this planning has turned out a beautiful Thanksgiving dinner? Leftovers. Any tips?
Yeah, well, of course, there's the midnight sandwich in our house. We eat it about 4, and so by after you're done with all the dishes at about 11 or 12, you're starving again. Mm-hmm. You can do turkey omelets in the morning. You can make a frittata, which is a baked omelet. You can do a turkey pot pie. You could even buy frozen pie crust and just mix the leftover vegetables and the leftover turkey and a little bit of stock and put pastry over it, and you'd have a pot pie. Anything you'd use chicken with, you can use the turkey. The other thing to do is if you've had a huge bird, you're going to get sick of all these leftovers. Freeze some of them, and in 2 months, you'll be thrilled to see it again.
Kathy Gunst, I have a feeling Thanksgiving dinner at your house would be sensational and very well organized.
Why don't you stop by?
I'd love to. Maybe I will.
Happy Thanksgiving.
You too. Your words have soothed, I hope, many a cook's already jangled nerves. Here and Now's resident chef and cookbook author, Kathy Gunst. For more information on Kathy's Thanksgiving tips and her book, Relax, Company's Coming, check out our website at here-now.org.
Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you candy. Come on to my house.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio and have a great Thanksgiving.
Safe traveling and join us again, Here and Now.
Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you figs and dates and grapes and cakes, eh? Come on to my house, come on. Come on to my house, come on. Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you candy. Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you everything.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
We'll find out why China may soon be building more efficient cars than the U.S.
And an update on our annual pilgrimage to see snow geese in Vermont.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.